Okay. Hey, welcome to Paragliding Banter. And on today's episode, we have Joanna Di Grigoli, all the way from Annecy, France. I'm excited to talk to her about her experience in a long, long career. Welcome, Joanna, to Paragliding Banter. Thank you for coming on the podcast.
Well, thank you for the invitation. It's a pleasure.
All right. I think we need to speak a little bit louder, Joanna, but okay. I think we'll get there. So I think you've been flying since the year 2000, and that means you have a career spanning 21 years. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, I started to fly in May the year 2000 nonstop until today.
Wow. Wow. That's awesome. 21 years. I started flying in 2008, but I had done a few courses before, but let's count that up. So that's awesome. Okay, so let's give our audience a little bit more information about you, Joanna. Although you're all over the net, there's a lot of information. We love seeing your videos and how you explain your flights. So Joanna is originally from Venezuela, where she learned flying and soon started competing within probably 2 years. As a kid, she always was interested in anything that flies. She was fascinated by birds. And her favorite toys were a hydroplane and a winged pony. Am I right, Joanna? Yes. Just like me, I wanted paper planes all the time. So now Joanna not only flies paragliders, but is also into skydiving and also does a little bit of ultralight flying. Right? Awesome.
Yeah, well, I did less than 100 jumps. Skydiving. Wow. Jumps, and then I stopped. Well, it was very pricey and time-consuming, and well, we were always depending on the drop zone. And at the time, things were a little bit tough in Venezuela with the planes and the spare parts. So sometimes the drop zone was closed for 6 months. So I decided to stop. And yeah, well, also the ultralight, I flew for about 3 years, but I haven't flown in over 10 years. So I'm an ultralight pilot,
but that's a win for
like to do it again.
That's a win for paragliding. You couldn't do that and we got you in paragliding. That's awesome. Also, you are a translator and you're in charge of the Cross Country magazine in Spanish.
Yes, I work for Cross Country magazine, and I've been working for them for 5.5 years. And I had the idea of having the magazine in Spanish because there wasn't really an international magazine in Spanish. So I had the idea, they liked it. And yeah, I'm in charge of the Spanish version. And sometimes I write articles for the English magazine, and I go on missions with them, like Cupicar or
Mix
Alps or events like that.
Cool, that's awesome. Although wherever she flies, wherever Joanna flies, she calls it home. But right now you're based in Annecy, France, right? Is that right?
Yes, I've been here since the year 2016.
Okay.
So yeah, it's been my home ever since then.
That's awesome. I've got a few friends over there, and Theo is over there. I see him practicing, and I want to visit that someplace. The plan was to do that in 2020 for us to fly in Annecy, but the pandemic really messed up. So soon, maybe. So, and some of your achievements, Joanna, include you're the winner of Coupe Fédéral de Distance in 2017 and 18. You're a 2-times FAA World Cup, World XE League winner, 17 and 18. You're 2-times X Contest winner, again, 17, 18. You're the second place at British Open, South American female distance record of 400 kilometers in 2016. And if I continue any longer with all your other wins, I don't think you get a chance to talk. So I've got to stop over there. And really, Joanna, it's a pleasure to have you on this podcast, and thank you for joining us. And we'd like to talk to you today about your flying career, your experience in competitions, and mostly what we would like to know from you is your techniques and your advice to club pilots and people who are moving from club pilots to intermediate pilots and who are into getting into competitions. So we just want to know from you. So we'll start, Joanna. What are you doing currently? Let's just start from there. What are you in Annecy? What are you doing? Do you fly every day? How is it over there?
Well, I fly whenever I get the chance. I'm working a little bit less, and at the moment I'm working part-time, and yeah, I try to fly as much as possible this year. Yeah, it's been a little bit more complicated than the previous years in terms of weather and with work and stuff. And so I feel like I've been flying a little bit less. I flew for some reason a lot this winter, but since the spring came, I don't know, I had always something to do, but I tried to get out as much as possible, even if it's only a short hike and fly before work, or a local flight or XC flight. I tried to get in the air as much as possible, because I think it's important to have a big volume of hours. Even if it's just a top to bottom, it's still a takeoff and a landing. It's always training.
Right.
Because the good thing about our sports that it's always unpredictable, that it's not in a court where, you know, if you hit the ball like this and you have specific measures, even if you launch from the same site every day, it's going to be different. So yeah, I think that even a top to bottom early in the morning is nice training.
Perfect. That's exactly what we see, that every time we go up to fly and conditions differ, and it's always a different situation, the same side, but different flights. I know you fly for Jin, but would you, the audience is very interested in knowing the equipment side of it also. We hardly speak about that, but it's very important to know the developments in equipment and what's really available. So what do you fly with? What's your equipment right now?
Well, my cross country and competition wing is a Leopard.
Okay.
I've had already, I'm on my third Leopard already. So it's a glider I know pretty well. I've had it since it came out. That's my main gear. And I fly with a Genie Race 4.
Okay.
Then for short hiking flies, I have a Yeti 5 with a convertible, a reversible harness.
Okay.
From Jin, of course. And I also have another hike and fly gear. I use a Camino with an X-Alps harness, and I use that whenever I want to do a short hike. And okay. But it's thermic, so I want to fly around a little bit. And I found it pretty useful in the fall, that conditions are not great anymore for cross country, but it's nice to go somewhere, not to a local site, but in the mountains, make a short hike and do a little cross country flight around. And also because I've always had to carry so much weight, so much ballast, that finding this light gear has opened up new possibilities for me
to open up. Yeah.
Because if I see that the day is not great, and sometimes I would say, no, I don't want to fly today, it's really cloudy, it's only for just you know, going back and forth in front of takeoff, oh, it takes me longer to get dressed than to fly. So yeah, I would rule that day out and not fly. And then when I took this other gear, this lightweight gear, and I said, well, now I don't have any more excuses. I can do a short hike, or even I can go out by car and make a short flight and not worry that that it's just a hassle and ballast and all the instruments and all this stuff. So it's just very minimalist and do a hike and it's or not. and it's easier to, for example, to top land, because Annecy, for those who don't know the Planfait takeoff, it's very small, it's very crowded, and it's surrounded by trees. So when you go in to land, it's like, it's a one way, there's no way to go back and abort the landing, only if you decided in advance. So if you land a little bit hard and you have ballast and all that stuff, it could be a little bit dangerous. You can get injured. So with this lighter gear, I can do that no problem. Of course, when it's not so crowded and not in the summer when there's a lot of people or conditions are full on. So yeah, having this other gear has opened up new possibilities, and yeah, I'm really enjoying it, because yeah, before I used to make excuses like, no, I'm not gonna fly today because the day is just like, or the day is stable, it's gonna take me forever.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's mainly my gear.
So I've seen, I know what takeoff you're talking about. I've seen a video of you where you have come back to land over there and you try to descend down, but you're unable to. And then you decide to land a little bit further at a higher ground and then you walk to your car. So I saw that footage of you trying to descend. And I know that there are those trees and there could be some rotors coming in. So
yeah, that takeoff was Marlon. Okay. Which is not exactly the lake takeoff.
Okay, that's not the one. Okay, sorry. Well,
no, it's not the one. Yeah, but it's also a tricky takeoff to Topland.
Okay. So I forwarded your video to a friend of mine just a few hours back, and I said, look at her decision to land. And he went through that, and there was a question that he asked. He said, how does one know the valley winds, where are they coming from, when especially when they are very less when it's less windy, when they're not that fast? So what are the things that you look for? In we don't fly in the valleys over here as much as you guys do, so we're a little sketchy about the valley winds and how things work. And also during in that video, you when you're crossing the lake, you've shown a direction where the wind is coming from the south usually, but today it isn't. So how are you calculating that? What are the signs that you're looking for when the wind isn't that strong?
Okay, well, first of all, well, we look at the forecast, of course, but sometimes, many times, it's there are mistakes in the forecast, and when you right. cannot be fixated on the forecast, otherwise it's not useful. But you look at your speed. That's the first thing I look, it's at my speed. Fortunately today, most of us fly with GPSs. And so you can look at your speed, your ground speed, and you can figure out how fast or how slow you're going and figure out if you're going tailwind or sidewind or headwind. But also the lake, it's a great indication. Whenever you have a body of water, it's a great indication. If the lake is flat, of course there's hardly any wind. But if you have little like ripples on the lake, you can see where the wind is coming from. For example, I can draw it really quickly. If you have a lake.
Right.
And the wind is coming, you have, for example, trees on one side, and you can see that the ripples are on the opposite side of the lake. Well, the wind is coming from this direction, right?
That's because right.
From the direction where the trees are.
Trees are.
Because when there are, where there are no ripples, is the shade, the wind shade of the
right.
the rotor of the, right. of the trees. So that's a good indication. Bodies of water are a great indication. If there are fires, if there's someone burning wood
smoke.
Or whatever, that's a great indication. What else?
Leaves, the trees, leaves when you come for landing.
Yeah, when you're coming for landing, of course, when you're near the ground, you can see the leaves, especially those trees who have leaves that change color when they turn around because of the wind, they have a different color.
So you can see that,
so you can see that, but that depends on the vegetation. But in places that are dusty, of course, you can see the dust that picks up because, for example, there's a truck. If there's a dirt road, for example, and there's a car or a truck coming by, you can see the direction of the dust, and that's a great. Or if there's especially in the summer, that all the fields are being treated, there's a tractor doing something, it's always going to pick up some dust or some leaves or grass, and that's a great indication. Here in Europe, the good thing is that people have been flying for so long that there's almost, and there I think in Switzerland there's even a map with the valley breezes of all the countries, so everybody knows.
Okay.
There's a big knowledge of how the valley breezes behave, and
right.
depending on the meteo wind, how they're going to behave, if they get stronger due to a specific meteo wind direction, or if they get weaker because of that wind direction. For example, on that video, that I posted that your friend saw. In Annecy, whenever there's a northerly meteor wind, the valley breezes are going to get stronger.
Okay.
But whenever you have westerlies or southerlies, those winds are not going to encourage the valley breezes that much. They're going to almost not stop it, but they're not going to encourage it as much as a northerly wind. So that's why you cannot trust the valley breezes in case you're low and you need to get support from a ridge or something.
Okay.
So yeah, all those are indications.
Okay, that's good to know. We do the same thing. We look at what the main indications for us is the smoke. We fly on the outside of. I'm talking about Bir when I talk about this. So have you flown in India?
Never.
Oh,
unfortunately, okay. I haven't had the chance to go.
Okay, then we look forward to seeing you. So yeah. Bir is again the same thing, but when you go back mountains, then there are valley winds and that things that we need to think about. But we also, I'm based in Bombay in the western part of India. So the local sites over here are not the valley based, but we have our small hills separated by some few kilometers. So we fly from one to the other, and also we have a lake. We look at the ripples, and those are really, really good indicators. And especially when it's not working, but it's about to work, and we see the ripples come across. So yeah, but valley winds is something that we, like you said, the knowledge that you have gained over there is something that we need to also work and learn.
Another good indication is birds, of course.
Yeah.
If there are birds flying by and you see them land, of course you're gonna land headwind like we do.
Exactly. That's a good one.
Even if they're standing on a cable or on a tree, they're always gonna be standing
facing the wind. Oh yeah, I never thought of that. That's a good one. Okay, so this is a question that's for understanding what kind of flying conditions are in your part of the world where you are now versus maybe your hometown or other places that you flew. So you're spending more time here. What are the conditions like? What's the difference that you see?
The main difference that I see is that here in the Alps, you play a lot with the sun.
Okay.
And people don't seem to pay that much attention to the meteor wind. Of course, they take it into consideration, but they play more with the sun. They always launch and they go straight to east face because that's where the sun is hitting in the morning, and that's what's going to work in the morning. In Venezuela, I would have never done that because I don't know why, but we never thought about that. And also the topography, the terrain is different. But here, because it's just rocky faces, in the morning we go straight to the east faces, and then when the sun switches to the other side, we go to the westerly faces. That's the main difference that I've seen here. And of course, that you have to take into consideration the valley winds. That's also a little bit tricky. But even if there's strong wind, people we hide into those faces. If, for example, if there's westerly wind, you hide under the mountain to get protected, to get sheltered from that wind, and you're still flying, you're climbing, and you're under this sort of bubble. And I found that pretty interesting. Actually, when we arrived here in Europe, I realized I thought I didn't know how to fly because I didn't understand a thing. What people were doing, how you were supposed to fly here. And I had to relearn how to fly and forget everything I knew and understand what people were telling me and were showing me and watching other people fly. In Venezuela, we fly more with the wind, not because it's windier, but because, in the places where I flew, the mountains were lower, they were not rocky like here. So maybe you couldn't get all these, you couldn't take advantage of the east faces of the sun like we do here. Of course, the thermals are where the sun are, but for us going into the lee side was unthinkable. And here you're always flying in the lee side, and I found that pretty interesting. So that's a main difference. Also, well, here in France, I haven't had the chance yet to fly in the flats. It's a type of flying that I enjoy because it's very technical. It makes you think more. Also, I feel like I have more freedom to fly because I just go wherever the wind takes me. In the mountains, you depend on the cloud base, on the ridge, on so many things. Whereas in the flats, when I go to Brazil or even Venezuela, when I used to fly in the flats, it was really nice because you have all this freedom to go to fly wherever you want, wherever the wind takes you.
Right.
So that's a main difference that I found here.
Okay, so Venezuela sounds similar to India now, those conditions. you said something about, although it's the east side of the mountain which is being heated, but you take the shelter on the west side, which is what you had to learn in the French Alps.
No, the opposite. You're in the east face.
Okay, you're in the east face.
Even if there's westerly wind, for example.
Okay.
You are below your shelter, and from this wind, or even if there's northerly or whatever, you're protected by the mountain. You're sheltered from this wind.
And I would think about rotors if I'm on the east side and there are westerly winds going.
Pardon?
I would think about rotors if I'm on the east side and there are westerly winds going. Yeah, that's a lot of de-learning.
Yeah.
All right, cool. And what do you think about the strength of the thermals in Annecy versus Venezuela? Are they stronger in Venezuela or are they drifty in Venezuela because of the wind?
Well, it depends on the place because we have all sort of terrain in Venezuela. We have flats, we have hills, we have the Andes, we have mountains covered in forests. We have all sorts of terrain. And so depending on the place, we could have very strong thermals. Thermal in 10 meter per second thermals.
Wow.
In Venezuela,
wow.
Flats, even in the mountains in the Andes. So it just depends on the terrain. What I find that here in the Alps, it's really rare to have a smooth thermal from the bottom to the top. It's really very rare that there's a day that you just enjoy the core, that start thermaling, and then you don't move until you don't move that break until you reach the cloud base. Adjusting your turn and drifting, and the core is changing and stuff, and it's a little bit bumpy until you arrive to the cloud base. In Venezuela, because I barely flew in the really high mountains in the Andes. I only went once a year for a competition, and that was enough. Because it's a place where,
yeah,
unfortunately, it's always very windy.
Right.
So you had the wind and the valley breezes and the strength of the thermals, and never high enough cloud base. So it was a very unpleasant place to fly. But
right,
in the other mountains where I used to fly, the distance between the terrain and the cloud base was always pretty high. So you always had a lot of room between the ground and the clouds. So most of the times you could find very smoother thermals. Even if they were strong, they were smoother, unless it was a particularly windy day or something. But being so close to the terrain at the beginning, and still sometimes, it's psychologically tough here, that you have to, be really next to a rocky face, because that's the only way to go up.
I've seen your track on the video on Avery, and you actually go up, you do S turns, and once you clear the trees, you're thermaling in a circle, but then you move away a little bit and then you start thermaling again. So I wondered why you did that
thermal,
but now when you say that, I realize
that thermal disappeared there. I was climbing.
Yeah.
And then I went to look for another thermal. And yeah,
it was right next to that.
Yeah, exactly. It was right next to it. So yeah, it's pretty funny that on that first climb, it's always like that. It's very rare that you just hit one climb to the cloud.
Straight to the cloud base,
Also, the reason I explained on that video that at the beginning I was doing only S's
Right.
It's because the trees, they didn't have any leaves. So it was really weird because I didn't have the reference of how far the trees were, because, you know, it's brown and you also have the ground that it's brown. Everything's brown. So it was really weird. You know, I didn't have the depth of it. So normally when the leaves are already there, you can, you know, circle up since the beginning, because early in the mornings, you know, thermals can be really punchy and narrow. So it's better to circle them. But yeah, that day was particularly weird because it was all brown and I wasn't sure how close I was to the trees.
It gives us a taste of that area, really, that track really tells us. So it's good learning. Okay, so although you've been flying for, so my next question was about value winds, but we already spoke about that. So I'm going to move on to the next one. I want to get a little bit more into your techniques and understanding and also your mind space. So I'm going to start at the start. So although you've been flying for 21 years or so, and probably you have got a particular process in getting to start to fly, when do you actually start planning to fly? What's your plan? Do you, for example, we think about the weather first and we get a gear together, then we have to drive about 120 kilometers away. But what does your planning include? Do you really take a look at your gear, or is all once it's packed after you land, you never look at it? Just want to get an idea as to what goes on in your mind and your actions.
My gear is always ready to go, always. Okay. Only if I know there's going to be a period of 3 weeks or something, or in the winter that I'm not going to fly as often, I lay my glider flat and it's out of the bag. But once it's spring and summer, it's always in the bag, ready to go. I always keep my instruments here in my office, so they're ready to get charged, to download my track log or whatever. Only if I have to do an adjustment, I try to do it, of course, after I fly at home, when I get home, or when I decide, well, tomorrow is a nice day, I look at the weather. Well, let's start at the beginning. First, I look at the weather for the next few days.
Right.
And then I decide what kind of flight I'm going to do. If the weather's good enough for XC flight or for a local flight or for a hiking flight. It also depends on work, of course. If I have tons of work, I won't have time to take 3 days off, you know, the entire day. So I'd say, well, if I have lots of work, I say, well, okay, let's see what are the two best days of the week. And I plan for it. If the week is looking average, then I can say, well, I can fly every day for a couple hours and that's it. Fortunately, I live very close to the sites. So for example, for my hike and fly sites here next at home, it's a walk. It's an hour and 20 minute walk. So I live from my door and I land next to the door. So that's easy. For local flights, it's a half an hour drive. And for XC flights, it's like about an hour drive. So the distance are pretty decent. So after I see which days I'm going to take off or what days are best for flying, I start talking to my XC buddies to see who can fly, what are we going to do, what the plan is, etc. And as the day approaches, we see how the weather evolves, because of course the forecast changes every day. Of course, we decide where to go. And because my kit is ready, I don't have to worry much about it. I just check that the radio is charged, that my GPS, Vario, and satellite tracker are charged.
Yeah.
Then I charge my GoPros, my cameras to be ready to capture the moment. And that's it. The previous night, what I do is I try to go to bed early. I try to turn the computer off early and not watch TV late at night, because if you're watching TV, you're getting, and social media, you're getting like stimulated. So it's better to calm down. That way you're going to get a better sleep, and I have a light dinner I have like a, I don't know, a salad or something. I'm not gonna, and earlier I'm not gonna have a big meal at night. And what I do sometimes, I even feel my ballast the day before.
I was just going to ask you about that.
Yeah, I feel my ballast the day before. Yeah. That way they're ready. And I even feel my camelback the night before.
Right.
So something else, I prepare the food that I'm going to take. I usually take nuts and dried fruit, and I put all that in a little bag. And so I can prepare that in the previous night because it's not going to get spoiled or something. So what else? So yeah, I try to leave as much as possible ready that night, because then I don't have to go to bed and think, yeah, tomorrow I have to fill my ballast. I have to prepare this. I leave everything ready. So in the morning, I can sleep a little bit more and
be more
relaxed and have breakfast. And also because I use a peeing device for women. Right. That needs some preparation.
Right.
So that takes me about 15 to 20 minutes to get ready. And so I need to take that into account.
Right.
So that's kind of like my preparation. But I think that it's better to have your gear always ready. For example, my flying jacket, my gloves, they're always inside. All I have to take is my instruments, my ballast, and that's it. Everything's ready.
So it's a very interesting thing, because people might not think that this affects flying, but this does affect flying a lot, because your preparation right from start, if your mind is clear, you can make better decisions. If you get onto the flight and think, oh shit, I forgot my jacket, I should have taken that. Or you said something that's very important, but never spoken so much about, is winding up early the previous night. And I had a chat with Dr. Matt Wilkes on my podcast, and he said even having a beer or two the previous night will bring down your performance the next day in your decision-making skills, and having a heavy dinner or having a late night. So you really don't, you might not see it now, but if you're very well rested, you have a better flight and a better chance of making good decisions.
Yeah, of course, because we all know that paragliding is a mental sport, and your mind needs to be clear. Your problems need to be solved as much as possible. So if you're going to be flying, thinking about work or whatever, it's happened to me, especially this year. I've been a little bit more stressed than other years. And there are a couple flights that I just went and landed in perfect days. And that unfortunately I didn't have the headspace, because I had I was thinking about, I need to send this email or this document or whatever, and I wasn't focused on the flight, and if you're not focused, it can be dangerous. So when you eliminate those things, you have more headspace for flying. So even for resting the night before, like I said, if you go to bed and you start thinking, is my jacket in my bag? Did I charge my GPS? Did I do this? Did I do that? So I have like a little ritual before my XC flight. And I found that works for me. Every person is different, but it's like when you went to school and you saw the person next to you who didn't have his pencil or his marker or forgot a book or whatever. Whereas if you made your bag the night before, everything was in. Exactly. So it's the same of, but it's funny when you arrive on takeoff and you see people who forget their gloves. Why? Why do you forget your gloves? I've seen people arrive on takeoff without a helmet. Unless you have to use the same helmet for different gear for your hike and flight or something. Fortunately, I've been able to have a piece of gear for every different activity. I don't have to switch helmets back and forth, etc. And even gloves. Sometimes gloves I have to switch depending on the season. But now that it's summer, I have nothing switches from one bag to the other.
Yeah. That's right, because I do the same. I've got two kids, one XE, one Echo, and everything's in there. And I used to always keep two different helmets also. But I've realized that if you keep the helmet and the electronics together, when you charge them, then you don't tend to forget that. So then you just move the helmet back to this bag and then you're ready to go.
Okay, what I do is I keep the gloves inside the helmet.
Yeah, me too. I keep the gloves, the radio, GoPro, Vario, everything inside the helmet. And the only thing that's outside the bag is the Camelback and the ballast for XC.
For obvious reasons.
Yes, for obvious reasons. I've already spoiled Vario with the water inside. So yeah, I've learned the lesson. Yeah. Okay, so my next question is, now that we're ready to fly and you go to the takeoff, what are the conditions for XC flying that you would say, no, I'm not going to take off? You've seen the prediction, the weather forecast, and it's said it's good for flying. But when you go to a particular takeoff and you say that, no, I don't want to fly, what would be those conditions? When would you say no?
Here in the Alps, strong wind, definitely. Yeah, I think that's the only thing, because I never go XC flying too late in the day, so it wouldn't be strength of the thermals. If I go for a local flight, for example, and the valley breezes are already too strong, or the conditions are too strong, sometimes I decide not to fly. But for XC, it would be that the wind is stronger than forecasted. Fortunately, the places that I fly in, they allow you to do to take off, and if you don't like it, you can go straight to landing field, and you just try it by yourself. But I remember it was last year. It was one day that I went down on the cable car because we arrived. Conditions were on the limit. It was just a day to arrive and launch right away. And it wasn't that interesting. But as soon as we got ready and we looked around a little bit, the wind picked up and it was a group of us. And we said, we're just going to take the cable car down. So for me, it would be the wind here in the Alps.
So it could also be possible that while you're making that decision, there are other people who are taking off. In spite of that, you make that decision.
Oh, in spite of that. I'm known for that.
Okay, good. That's very interesting.
I'm known for that even in competitions. And especially in competitions that sometimes you wait until it's too late to fly, unfortunately. And you have people, they push for flying and you have everyone showing you the conditions. But in many competitions, I've said, I'm not flying, and I drive down.
Go ahead.
No, because for me, my life and my health is more important than points or kilometers or whatever.
That's a big point.
And I want to fly the next day, the next year, the next whatever. And so I don't think I think my life and my health is more important than some wooden trophy.
That's a very important point to take in. Everyone has to judge that for themselves. Yeah. What, according to you, is a strong wind? Would it be 20 kilometers? Would it be?
Well, here in the Alps, I think, maybe 20 kilometers will be already windy enough.
Okay.
For XC, for local flights, I've flown in that wind. Right. For example, in ANSI, that it's you're not like inside of a narrow valley or something, and if you don't like it, just get away and land. But if I'm going to go XC that I know that I'm going to be under in Lee or something, 20 kilometers already.
Okay. Just to get a perspective, an idea, because strong for you could be strong for, not strong for somebody else. So we need to get an idea,
The tolerance is different for everyone. And
that's right.
People should be really aware of that. Aware of their level, of their level of tolerance, and of their skills.
Right.
If you feel you have the skills for it, the experience, and go for it. But if you are, for example, a beginner or intermediate or even an advanced pilot, and you say, I don't like that kind of conditions, just don't fly. And you say, I'm not willing to fly in those conditions, or you realize you don't have the skills or the headspace. It's funny because sometimes I found myself flying in really strong conditions and being okay with it. And then flying in other conditions that are not so strong and everyone being okay, and me going to land, because that day I didn't have the headspace, or I was worried about something, or I didn't sleep well, or whatever, or just your body is not feeling okay for it.
So the mature decision is, and the mature thought process, is that even though you go and land while your other friends are still flying, it's all right. There's no feeling of shame in that, because it's not good for you that day, because there's a lot of ego playing here, you know. Oh, but I was flying, why did you go and land? And, you know, people tend to push them when they shouldn't.
Yeah, so I think it would be important when you can tolerate some conditions, but your other pilots can't, that you should be supportive. Yes. Just ask them, why did you go land? And that person is going to tell you, I didn't like the condition. So the right thing to say would be, well, that's okay. If you don't like it, if you didn't like it, it was a good call to go land it. Not go on and say, the conditions were fine. I did 100 Ks or whatever. That's not the right answer. I think you should support the person so they understand, so that was good. And it's a good thing to ask. So you try to understand. And also that they understand that they landed not because conditions were particularly dangerous, but that they were not suitable for them.
That's exactly.
And so I think that's really important to be supported with pilots who make that decision.
And always tell, we always fly with people. We don't fly alone. We always have a group of people flying with us, our own buddies. But there are some people who are now graduating from the school and want to fly, and they don't have any buddies around. So they just end up going to these big places where big flights are happening, and they just think that, you know, come on, we can do it. And they shy away from asking and talking to other people. So we've been doing a lot of local discussions, local calls over here, and talking to these people, our fellow pilots who are our friends, and telling them that it's okay to talk to people. Just talk to senior pilots, approach us and talk to us, and we'll tell you what we feel. And we'll, of course, you have to get your landings and takeoffs right. That's a given. So yeah, it's a mature decision. Be supportive. That's a very important message to be given out. Yeah.
For example, I feel very fortunate that, because when I learned to fly, I had like big brothers who always took care of me. They were not overprotective, but they always pushed me a little bit, of course, but they would always say, well, you know, maybe wait a little bit, or they would launch first, and then on the radio they would say, yeah, it's okay, you can go, and they would take me. They told me, well, go register in a competition, you're going to learn a lot, come fly XC with us and stuff. And I really appreciate that. And I realized how important it was only a couple months ago, because I went flying with this pilot who's just starting to thermal. And he told me, I'm completely lost. I don't know when to go, where to go, etc., or what time to go. Or I'm completely lost because I'm alone. And I'm like, there are so many pilots here, and this pilot feels alone because he doesn't have anyone to help him. So you, in countries like this, you depend a lot on the local club and the activities they have. Whereas in small countries where there are fewer pilots, like in Venezuela, we were so few pilots that we would just took care of each other.
Right.
So that's when I realized how important. It was to take care of beginners or any pilot, that you just, you know, take care of them.
It could also be your friend who's been flying with you forever, but that particular day he's having a bad day, and you know, it's good to look out for each other.
Yeah, exactly.
So, okay, so now that you've arrived on the scene and you've taken off, we want to get into the main topic, but everybody seems to be wanting to know things, which is thermaling. It's an art. It's different for different people. Everyone's got their own techniques. The basis is the same. You find a thermal, you find the core, and you go up. But many people approach it in different ways. Some people like to go explore first. Some people just find whatever it is and just stay in there and try to find out if the thermal, if you're home based like us. We have a windy condition, and the thermals are always slopey. So we always have to extend our turn to stay inside. And so it's an art, and everybody wants to know more about it. What can you tell us about Thermalink? What do you do, and what should a person who is just out of the school, who is a club pilot now and learning, or XE pilots or experienced pilots, what should they know? What can you tell us about Thermalink?
Well, I'm not the exploratory type of pilot. I'm the type of pilot that when I find a thermal, I just stick to it and take advantage of it, unless there's an obvious sign of a better thermal elsewhere, a pilot who's climbing faster, a bird, or a cloud that's developing better. But for example, the way I thermal is how I feel when I enter the thermal. For example, if I feel that the whole glider is entering the thermal, then I can figure out that I'm entering behind the thermal, or the whole
glider. You're covered is in the thermal. Yeah.
So I don't go and turn directly to one side. I make like a quarter turn to one side, and then I start thermaling. That's how I do it. On the other hand, if I feel like there's only one side of the glider pulling, that's the side where I should turn to. For example, if I feel that the right side of the glider is going up, then I will turn to the right and then start correcting the turn accordingly how I feel. That's what I would do. I tend to turn very tightly. I've always done that. Even in smooth or in light thermals, I try to turn very tightly. That way, I don't know, it's always worked for me, and I've always climbed pretty fast. But yeah, that's what I do when I enter a thermal. Basically, as you say, it's an art. I would say it's dark magic or something. It's very mysterious. Something that I enjoy doing. Yeah. And for example, in days that are not good for XE, I just amuse myself going up and down thermals. I just go up the thermal, I glide, and then I come back, and I love that kind of training. But what else I could tell you? If, of course, we have to take an advantage drift and wind and all that. When I've flown in Brazil, I've been amazed of how my thermal looks in my GPS. As you say, that you drift and it goes like this, start drifting. I think the, I don't know, it's really hard to put it into words. But I think a really important part is entering it right, coring it, and staying in the core. And I really don't go and explore much. I see pilots who just go and explore the thermal, and they do all these patterns when they thermal, but I'm not that kind of person. Only if there are obvious signs. If you see, of course, a vulture, it goes choo, like that.
Yeah.
I go into a thermal, or in a competition, of course, that you have 100 people marking the thermal, that's easier. But I could say I might be a little bit stubborn in thermals and always stick to my core. Something that if you compete or you fly with a lot of people and you feel that the other people are distracting you, if you have a good thermal and you feel like you're getting disturbed by other people or scared, and you might get intimidated and run away from your thermal, what I do is that I blur those people out. I just focus on my turn, on my coring, on my thermaling, and I blur those people out. I see them as when you're driving, when you're driving, you know everything's there. Yeah. But you don't fixate yourself in a pedestrian or whatever. Otherwise, you're going to fly straight to it or drive straight to it. So that's what I do. I'm aware people are there, that people are up there, down there, but I try not to fixate on them. Otherwise, you get scared and you can leave the thermal. I've seen myself in that situation, and that's when I decided, okay, just not pretend, just make as if they were birds. That's it, and study the way their path, so you can know where to go. But not fixate on them.
How much support do you take of the vario? Is it more on the feel of the glider, or is it a mix of both?
Well, you're always going to react before your vario. That's something, even the most reactive varios today, you feel the thermal first and then the vario beeps. I flew without a vario for a long time, for the first 2 years.
Wow.
I flew without a vario. I got it actually because my friends told me, well, if you want to go XC, you should have a vario because you need to know what altitude you can leave the mountain. I was like, oh, really? Seriously? How come that? Sounds interesting. But I flung for 2 years without a vario. And I think that was very helpful because I learned how to feel the thermal by through the risers, through the harness, on your face, on the brakes. I got a very intuitive feel of the thermals that way. And yeah, of course, if I run out of vario, I feel a little bit lost for a minute, but I could thermal without a vario without a problem. But I would recommend all pilots to not buy a vario right away, just to feel that way. Even the light thermals, you can learn how to feel them through your glider, your harness, the risers, the brakes, everything.
That's the best learn. That's the best learning technique because you have to. I did the same. I didn't fly with a vario for for some time, and I could feel it. But then I got used to it. And now, when I don't have a vario, I get a little bit lost. But yeah, you're right that you need to develop that continuously.
Yeah, because you never know when you're gonna run out of battery,
or
your vario is gonna bug, or you forget your vario.
Okay. So now that we're flying and you transition with speed bar all the time. Full speed bar, or how do you look at the glide ratio on the vario and see which?
I'm not known for being a fast pilot or a pilot that pushes a lot of bar. I don't know why. Of course, if the conditions are smooth and I'm sinking a lot after a thermal, I need to get out of it, get away from it as soon as possible. So the best thing, of course, to push bar. But I'm not as mentally strong as to push bar when it's rowdy I'm not like that. That's something I like about cross country, that I can go my own pace and I'm not in a rush. Of course, in competition, I found myself just not letting the bar go at all, only for thermaling. And even I remember once it was a super final in Colombia. I remember I pushed so much that I remember that there was a moment that I pushed half bar and I was like, my glider is so slow. What's the problem? And it's because I was only pushing half bar. And I've been used to flying full bar all the time. And I was like, oh my God.
so used to that. Then. Yeah.
Yeah. So in cross country, I don't push that much because I don't know why. I'm not only looking at performance, but I'm only looking at enjoying myself.
So that's important.
If I'm in a long glide, of course I push a little bit of bar. For example, here that whenever you cross the lake, it's a very long glide. So yeah, of course I push a little bit of bar, but I am also taking photos and eating. So I'm having something to eat. So
That's the fun of flying, isn't it? It's the people that you meet. It's just not being in the air. Of course, that's the magic, but the whole thing it's surrounded with you meet your friends, you take pictures and think, you know, when I get the most high when I see a bird below me, when I see a bird from top. I mean, that's just amazing. Such a privilege.
Yeah, I'm not a person who's pushing by all the time. No,
right.
I really... And in transitions, in glides, I love watching the view, enjoying the view, having something to eat. I don't know. I'm like that. I realized that there was something wrong the day I stopped taking photos. I remember in competitions before, I used to stop and, you know, you were on glide and I would just take photos. And I had tons of photos of competition. And then I remember there was a day I said, wow, I have like 2 photos of the whole week. What's wrong? And it's because I was pushing like a maniac. And I said, well, okay, that's the point of competition, but that's not me. And yeah, of course, competitions are fun. You meet people, you learn a lot, you get to know new places and stuff. But you have to realize what your place in a competition is. Of course, it's fun to win, and yeah, the adrenaline and flying together and all that, it's fun. But I enjoy more cross-country flights. And of course, I'm stuck in Valley Breeze and I need to get out of here. Of there, of course, I push bar. And yeah, that's what gliders are for. When you have that, that's why you have that extra performance of a speed bar. But if I'm going tailwind and my glide ratio is okay, I don't know, why go faster? That's me, of course. If you're rushing against the clock you want to close a big FAI triangle or an outer return or whatever, yeah, of course, performance is everything, and push bar whenever you can. Last year, I remember I made a great flight. Conditions were just magical. It was very unstable since very early in the day. It was late July, and that was really rare to have such an unstable day here. Normally, conditions are more stable. And I remember I was able to push a lot of bar because I remember I had my video cameras rolling, and I was like, okay, let's push bar. So I was just pushing a little bit of bar, not too much, because of course it was really bumpy early in the morning, but I was cloud surfing with a little bit of bar, and it was great because it was not super bumpy or super strong, and I was enjoying the view. I was doing everything, and I was like, oh, this is fun to be able to push a little bit of bar, but I'm not a speed bar.
Okay. So how do you manage your self in turbulence? What's your reaction? Do you go through turbulence, or you try to get away from spearing in turbulence?
Well, if being in turbulence means climbing, unfortunately, you've got to go through that.
Yeah.
Yeah. For example, the other day I went flying with a friend, and we were flying on a southeasterly face. And it's a place that it's known for flying whenever there's strong north. And that's where they were going to do the world championships this year in Molambea. So it was a little bit rowdy, but once you got on the top, on the right side, you were no longer in the lee, it was pleasant. I was with a friend, and she just couldn't stand it, and she would go away. And I wouldn't have a radio, but I would have loved to tell her just, stay there because it's gonna stop eventually. The turbulence is gonna stop. You just need to put up with it for a few seconds, and then it's gonna be great. The rest, because if you stay low all the time, you're gonna stay in the turbulence the whole time. So yeah, if I can avoid it, if I have another choice, of course I'm going to avoid it. Even I found myself climbing in less rowdy thermals. If I see a pilot who's climbing, maybe faster, but he's taking lots of collapses or something, and I'm flying and I'm climbing a little bit slower in a nicer thermal, I just stay in my thermal. If I have that choice.
Yeah.
But in some places, you're in a hole, you're in the middle, in a ridge, and you just need to get out of there. And the only solution is to climb that rowdy thermal. Of course, I take it because that rowdy thermal is going to take me to smoother air, and you need to get out of there. I think it's just depends on the mode you're flying, if you're in survival mode or not. In survival mode, you just take whatever you can to get out of there, because sometimes that means safety later on than not taking that thermal and getting stuck in really strong valley breeze and landing at the bottom of a narrow valley that's gonna eventually be more dangerous.
Yeah.
So that would be my approach to it.
Right. Yeah, makes sense. So we're coming to the end of it. So I just don't want to keep you for more time, but just a few more questions. Like you mentioned that you finally figured out the best way to fly in a competition is to always fly with the gaggle and not to go away from the gaggle. Is there a reason for that?
Well, I think things have changed a lot in competitions. Before, I remember that gliders used to have different performances. Even if we were all in uncertified competition gliders, the performances were very different. Nowadays, all gliders have almost the same performance, so they all still stay together. So before, the gaggle, or the whole field, it would get spread out in different groups. You have the first, second, you name it, groups. And So you were able to make your own decisions. Now, because the group is staying together all the times, because we all have the same performance, there's no more thinking to do. Right. You just need to stay with the gaggle, and because, well, united we're stronger. That's we all know that. If you stay together, people are gonna show you the better climb. You go with them, and then you need to climb better than them to be in the top and be in the front of the gaggle. But if you go on your own and trying to reinvent the wheel or something like that, alone you're gonna be slower, and you might miss a climb 50 meters away from you. Whereas if you're in a gaggle, you're looking at all.
Somebody is pointing it out to you somewhere.
Exactly. Yeah. There are some days though that people get spread out, and people make decisions, and it's the only way. It would have to be a really particular day, a day that got shaded out, and a big group landed, and others survived who were a little bit, you know, higher or behind or whatever. But for some reason I always wanted to reinvent the wheel and go my own way, because I'm a cross-country pilot, and I'm used to flying on my own. So, but in competitions today, that just doesn't work. So I realized that it was a mistake to do that. And today you just need to push bars, stay with the group, and that's the only way. And the only way to beat people, it's at climbing.
Right. If you climb first,
you're gonna be among the first who leaves, and not at the bottom and the tail of the gap. Right. So I think the competition today is at climb. Who climbs better? And that leads to aggressive flying sometimes.
Right.
People who just turn too tight and a little bit of aggressive at that thermal, because they want to get the better core and climb faster. And maybe that's something that has pushed me away a little bit from competitions.
Right.
Because for me, that's not so fun anymore. There's a lot of adrenaline in it, of course, because you're...
It's not fun anymore,
But I like more the decision making.
Right.
I like that better.
Cool. So now that we've gone ahead and taken a transition, now we want to land. Is your landing technique to induce more speed to land, or do you do your final glide based on trim speed? What's your...
It depends on the situation. For example, my thing is that I use ballast. So if there's no wind, I have to nail it, because I can't afford to land badly and spraining an ankle or worse. If there's no wind, of course, I would just make my approach depending on the field that I choose to land. And on the last approach, I just take a lot of speed and do a nice flare so I can just, you know, stick the landing. If there's wind, of course, it's easier for everyone.
Yeah, it's heavier.
I never push bar when I go landing. I've been practicing that a little bit with my lightweight kit, just to get used to the speed and in case I ever need that. But if there's wind, of course it's easier, and I just plan my approach accordingly. If there's a lot of wind, you have to be really careful not to be too far behind, otherwise you could land out of the field.
Right.
So it would depend on the conditions, but I don't have a special approach to landing. I think I'm very...
It's just according to the conditions.
Just according to the conditions,
Cool. Okay, so...
What I do try is to fixate on a point in the field.
Okay.
So I can try to train spot landings.
Spot landing,
Because that could be useful the day you need to land in a very tight field. Because if you say I have a big field and I can land wherever I want, then the day you have to do it out of necessity, you could land on a tree or something. And that's something I have lost here in Europe, because we have these big fields where to land. Where I used to fly in Caracas, we could only top land or land in these tiny little tiny field. Places. There was a helicopter pad. It was really tough to land. So I was very used to doing top landing and to landing really tight spots. But ever since I've been here, I've lost that training because we have those big fields, because it's forbidden to top land in most takeoffs. So I've lost that. And the only way I found to train that is to practice spot landing, even on a big field. For example, here in Annecy at the Talloire landing field, there's just a piece of fabric in the middle of a landing field. And I try to land on it or the closest I can.
Right.
So that's a good training. Or take a point of reference if there's a little bush or whatever, you land next to it.
Yeah, that makes sense. And you should use that fixation for the better purpose. Yeah. And
Because it's true that if when you fixate on something, you're gonna hit it. That's why people hit trees. That's why people hit the only tree on the landing field.
Yeah.
The only car, we've had that. The only whatever. So we have to use that fixation to our advantage.
Advantage, yeah. And you said in nailwind landing, when you have ballast, when you develop the speed, do you do a wing over, or do you just do a dolphin to develop speed, or you just come in minimum speed?
Well, it would depend on the traffic. If I'm on my own, I usually do S's behind the landing field, and I just, the last one, I just go for it. And maybe I would break if I'm high. I would break a little bit and then just give it full speed. So I just dive.
Okay.
But that's what I do the most often. I just dive and
develop
then
the
I
speed,
use
the,
how you call it, the ground effect.
Ground effect,
to glide really fast and then just give it a big flare.
Yeah. So the reason I'm asking this is there are a lot of young people who need to know this, because there are a lot of accidents on this, sadly. And you need to nail your takeoffs and landings. I mean, these are the places where you get hurt the most. And coming from you with so much of experience to hear this, I'm sure there will be some knowledge that will be imparted to these people. So really, thank you for that.
Yeah, of course. The best landing technique would be to lose altitude ahead of the field, upwind from the field, do 360s, and then do an airplane.
Yeah, the finals.
Yeah, final approach. Yeah. That would be the best thing because of traffic. If everyone does the same, that would be the best thing. Maybe I do the S's because I have more experience and I know I'm not going to stall my glider or something.
Right.
But it would be very important, because sometimes people, they get scared and they think they're going to overshoot and they tend to brake, to pull too much brake, and they end up stalling the glider. And
that close to the ground, Got it. Okay, so I'm going to come to the second last question, rather. This is for people who, this question is asked a lot of times, people right from club pilots to higher end pilots. When is the right time to switch to a glider? Like, so somebody who's on A, when does that person consider going to B? And if somebody's on a high B, when does a person consider going to C? What is that criteria according to you?
I would say when you're not having any more collapses on that glider.
Okay, that's, so energy management.
So if you're flying an A and, well, you've flown for a while and of course people wanna change gliders because they want more performance. So if you feel that you cannot do something because of your glider's performance, of course, then you need to change a glider. But for that, if you still have lots of collapses on an A glider, you should not change to a B glider.
Yeah.
So you should first dominate your glider, have enough skills for it, and then think about switching to another glider. A very good friend, one of my best friends, I remember I was on a C glider. It was my first C glider, and I just got it and I went flying. And I had a frontal. And I laughed about it. And I told him, oh, did you see I had a frontal? And he told me something very harsh, but then I appreciated it. And he told me, you cannot have a full frontal on a sea glider. If you have a full frontal on a sea glider, you don't have the skills to fly a sea glider. And I was shocked, and I felt it was really harsh. I was young. I was like, I don't know, like 24 years old. And I was kind of like, I was also kind of mad. I was like, why is he so harsh with me? And then I realized, like, yeah, he's right. And you cannot afford it. So I've told that to people. Maybe I haven't been so nicely, but when I've seen people throwing reserves on a big glider or something, I tell them, you should not be throwing a reserve on a big glider. Unless you were in the mother of all sides, or you were in a SIB course and something happened. But if in a thermal you have a collapse and that leads to a reserve throwing, you should not be on that glider. So of course, as coming back, when I wanted to change to a different glider is because when I started thermally, I wanted to start cross country, and I would see that there was no way I could make it to the next ridge or something. That I felt like the glider was really stopping me from doing that. And I hadn't had any collapses, and I had enough skills, and I decided to change that glider to a different glider, from a B to a C, for example. That was my progression. But still, I changed it, and it was the middle of the season. Conditions were strong. Right. And I remember I got scared because I went flying. Conditions were really, really strong and stuff. And I got scared. I was like, well, maybe this wasn't a good decision. So it's the time when you change your glider is also important.
Right.
You change it when... that depends on the country, but for example, in Venezuela, the best time to change your glider was in the middle of the rainy season.
Right.
It was the best way because the conditions were mellower. It was not so strong. It was not so windy, and that was the right time. You could do very mellow flights with it and progress really quickly thanks to that on your new glider. So here in countries with four seasons would be maybe in the fall or even in the winter. So you can do lots of top to bottoms, take advantage of the few thermally days that there are. And so it would be a matter of skills and also the timing when you change it. I think those are important things. And something important is that something that I saw with my own eyes is forget about the... how do you call it? Peer pressure.
Yeah, that's important.
I saw a group of pilots, and I saw them since they learned how to fly in Venezuela, and they were four friends. They took the course together, started flying together, and they started changing gliders. And but they didn't realize that each of them was progressing differently.
Right.
So one was very skilled, and he was making progress really fast, and the other two were progressing slower. Well, they all wanted to change gliders at the same time, and they start to step up. And then we started seeing the accidents. One of them stopped flying, and the other one got seriously hurt. He recovered, and he went flying again, and then he realized that he shouldn't have been flying a competition glider. Wow. And that was after many years. But my point is that they were good friends. They were always traveling. They learned how to fly together. They were traveling together. They were always flying together, but they were not progressing together. And that's something you should really know. If your friends are changing gliders, they're making good progress, but you're not, you should be honest to yourself and say, either I'm not interested in more performance, I'm fine. Maybe that type of flying is not for me, because maybe your friends, they want to do XC, they want to do competitions, they want to do big stuff, and you're just happy with your top to bottoms. You're weak in flying. Maybe you don't have enough, as much time as they do. Maybe you just don't like strong conditions, and that's okay. And what I love about paragliding today is that it's so diverse now. Before it was, I think it was only like, you know, you had to do XC competition and that was it, and maybe acro.
Yeah.
But now you see the gear has got so diverse, and the sport has diversified so much that now there's paragliding for everybody.
That's
for people who want to fly once a month, they just do a top to bottom. For people who want to run and fly, hike and fly, XC, there's a gear for everything.
Everything, that's right.
So now you have a lot of choices, but you have to figure that out for yourself, what you want from paragliding. If you want that, if you want only want to do top to bottoms your whole life, that's fine. If you're going to go and fly 500 kilometers, that's fine. But it's something you have to realize as a pilot, and you nobody can tell that to you. Nobody can, people can tell, yeah, you should change gliders. Yeah, you should compete or something. People can suggest it. Of course, it's nobody told me compete, you're going to learn more. Maybe I would have never done it. But you should listen to those suggestions, but realize where you are and what you want from the sport. I think that's super important now. And especially now that we have so much information. 20 years ago, there wasn't that much on the internet about paragliding.
That's right.
There were a few websites and stuff, but all the information, the forums, the Instagram, the Facebook, everything, all the videos, all the what we can see now on YouTube, we didn't have that 20 years ago, or we had very little. And now we see what's out there and what's available, and maybe you can say, yeah, I'd like to do this, and or I'd like to do that.
Very well said, Joanna. It's very important. These points are to be taken seriously. And this is something I would really endorse and say that just fly for yourself, fly for fun, fly for yourself and judge for yourself. Everybody can't be number one all the time. And as long as you enjoy and come back to fly.
Something we have to remember that we do this for fun.
Exactly.
This is supposed to be fun. And
yeah, it's not a competition. It's
supposed to be stressful.
That's right.
It's a risky sport, and yeah, we need to be aware respect of it that, and yes, treat it with respect. But it's right. The most important thing is to have fun.
My last question was, what advice are you going to give people with the XC career? But I think you already answered that. They need to do it for fun. Joanna, thank you so much. This has been a fun chat, and it's a very easy chat. I felt nice having a free flow chat with you. And we have covered many important topics in this, from your experience of flying and the things that you've shared with us. And I hope our audience really appreciates and likes this. I'm sure they will. But it was really fun. Like you said, paragliding should be about fun. Even chatting about paragliding should be fun. So yeah, thank you very much. And
thank you so much for the invitation. And I'm looking forward to going to India someday and meeting all of you and flying in your beautiful mountains.
Yeah, yeah. Please let me know whenever you want to come to India. We're happy to take you around, show you around. And Beer is a place where most of the people have flown and they really like it. And we'll be happy to fly with you. It'll be a pleasure. So thank you very much, Joanna. And thank you, audience, for listening to this podcast. If there's any feedback, you can always email me at emailsarjit@gmail.com. And I look forward to getting you back on a different episode soon. Thank you for joining Paragliding Banter and listening to this podcast. Thank you very much.